22. Up until now, the early afternoon of Tuesday, the 1st of August, the official response to Erin's lunch had been focused on delivering the best medical care and watching out for any wider threat to public health. But down at Wonthaggi Police Station, home to the Bass Coast Crime Investigation Unit, Detective Constable Darren Lomax was rubbing his chin. Well, I say that metaphorically. I don't really know what he was doing. But given that he was a criminal investigator, I am guessing he had heard about this family lunch that had ended up with four people in ICU and thought, hello, hello, hello. He decided to notify the Victoria Police Homicide Squad. He told them they had a reported mass food poisoning event at 84 Gibson Street, Leongatha. No one had died yet. It was just a heads up. Over at Homicide, Detective Stephen Eppingstall received Darren's notification and was now aware of the strange goings-on in the Latrobe Valley. Appropriately, considering Steve did not belong to the nearly Homicide Squad, it was not yet an official assignment. But ominously, Homicide was watching. If they had been watching closely, they would have seen Erin Patterson making her way down a long hospital corridor, past a drink vending machine to the children's wing of Monash Medical Centre. Erin had just been discharged, and she was visiting her two kids, who were still waiting to get the all clear. As she approached, she could see Simon, just outside the kids' room, on his mobile, deep in conversation. But he was doing more listening than talking. It sounded like he was getting an update from a doctor somewhere. He ended the call as he saw Erin approach and followed her into the room where Jack and Bronte were. The kids were bored. Neither of them was overly fond of hospitals, and now they were keen to get out. There was conversation with the children about why we're all here, recounted Erin during her evidence in chief, and why everyone else was unwell. And I remember explaining about how there was a concern that the lunch I had served on Saturday might have made people unwell. Just unwell? Erin, come on. And I remember Bronte saying something like, well, we weren't at the lunch. Why are we here too? And I explained to her that they had eaten the leftovers, but I told her, I scraped the mushrooms off yours and Jack's because you don't like mushrooms. And that opened up a conversation around mushrooms. And also around the dehydrator? Prompted Colin. That's right. I can't remember who initiated it, but I just remember conversation about, yeah. Bronte doesn't like mushrooms, but it's interesting that when I made muffins with dried mushrooms inside, as like a blind taste test, she preferred the muffin with the most amount of mushroom in it. We thought that was quite interesting. The story of the mushroom-spiked muffins was not new to Bronte or Erin. Erin had been open about the trick she'd played on Bronte at the time when the taste test had happened, back in May. It had become a family joke. It was news to Simon, though. He hadn't heard it before. Nonetheless, his recollection of this conversation in the kids' hospital room wasn't very different. Nanette Rogers' reason for highlighting the story with Simon soon became clear. Had you known Erin to dry mushrooms before? No, I don't think so, answered Simon. It felt like news to me that she dehydrated food. Did you know she owned a dehydrator? She persisted. I don't think so. Was it something that she did when you lived together? No, she didn't dehydrate food when we lived together, Simon answered. For Nanette, the muffin anecdote was an entree to planting the seed that Erin's decision to buy a dehydrator was unusual and out of character. In other words, it had been done with a bigger idea in mind, namely poisoning people. It was a story that served as an entree to a main course for Colin Mandy and Erin too. Now, at some stage, did the children leave the room? Asked Colin smoothly. They left the room a couple of times through that period to go to the vending machine. And who was left in the room? Asked Colin. Simon and I, Erin stated. And did you and Simon have any conversation? Yeah, so during that conversation with the children about the taste tests, and we had discussed in that conversation that I had dried mushrooms and how I had used a dehydrator to do that. And he said to me, "Is that how you poisoned my parents, using that dehydrator?" Colin just let that sink in for a second. "And what was your response?" he finally asked. I said, "Of course not. But it caused me to do a lot of thinking about a lot of things. It got me thinking about all the times I'd used it and I had used the dehydrator." "That's right." Erin was reliving the stress of this memory as she unpacked it, and how I had dried foraged mushrooms in it weeks earlier, and I was starting to think, what if they'd gone in the container with the Chinese mushrooms? Maybe that had happened. Yeah, I was thinking maybe that's how this all. Yeah. How did that make you feel? Scared? Responsible? Really worried, because we'd been told child protection were about to get involved, and Simon seemed to be of the mind that maybe this was intentional, and I just got really scared. It sounded, particularly for Erin, remarkably genuine. But had Simon thought it was intentional? Erin had certainly convinced us he might have. Or was that a misinterpretation? What was Simon's version of this exchange? Helpfully, Colin wanted to clear this up for us, and during his cross-examination of Simon, he gave him a chance to elaborate. "And after that conversation with the kids present, you and Erin were alone in the room together," Colin said evenly. Simon looked puzzled. I couldn't say for sure." Ever patient, Colin filled in the blanks. "Well, periodically the kids would leave the room and go to a vending machine or..." "Yeah, okay, it's possible that did happen, yeah. They did go to the vending machine, I remember that." But Simon didn't look comfortable. Where was this going? "And that was just after, let me suggest," continued Colin, "just after the conversation about the dehydrator, and you said to Erin, 'Is that what you use to poison them?'" "I did not say that to Erin." It was one of the firmest answers Simon gave during his 3 days in the witness box. Had he or hadn't he? Up until that last exchange, Erin and Simon were more or less in agreement about what had been said. Some details were different, but they both remembered the same general conversation, except for the last exchange. Erin was claiming that this exchange led to her making the string of bad decisions that followed, decisions made in a frantic effort to avoid being blamed for something that she had never intended to happen. Simon, on the other hand, was saying that last exchange, the exchange that Erin said had triggered all her incriminating behaviour, had never happened. Behind Erin's explanation lay the implication that, unless someone had accused her of causing harm intentionally, it wouldn't have crossed her mind that people might think that. It was only when someone else rudely pointed the finger at her that she panicked and did all those stupid things that had got her into this courtroom. It was all his fault. She did sound abnormally honest, though. I had to concede that. She spoke with that slightly resigned tone you hear when a person feels they probably won't be believed and they understand why, but they are actually telling the truth this time. And she had been facing 3 other attempted murder charges against Simon right up until the brink of this trial. We were meant to have forgotten those, I know. But if Simon already believed that Erin had been trying to kill him, he probably would think that her actions this time had been intentional. I knew that wasn't evidence, but we had also been told to use our common sense. I was putting this in that category. And although Simon denied ever saying it, I don't know. It was the sort of thing I could imagine he might say at that time, in those circumstances. I didn't know who to believe on this one. If innocent Erin was using this as a foundation stone to convince me that I'd been too quick to lose belief in her, it was working. It didn't swing me back to being her number one ticket holder, but it did make me hit the pause button. Hear the whole evidence first. Katrina Cripps is a practice leader in child protection for Victoria's Department of Families, Fairness and Housing. The Child Protection After Hours Service had received a report in relation to Jack and Bronte on the evening of Monday, the 31st of July. That report had proceeded to the Warragul Child Protection Team for further investigation and assessment, which is how it landed in Katrina's hands. It is what brought her and her colleague, Naomi Schroeder, to the Monash Medical Centre just after lunch on Tuesday, the 1st of August. What the report said and who sent it were never addressed in the evidence. I can only assume that the report was basically about the kids and irrelevant to the specific charges Erin was facing. Katrina's job was to assess whether the children were safe to remain in Erin's custody. She spoke to Simon first, then the children. Details of those conversations didn't form part of her evidence. But at 2:55 p.m, Katrina and Naomi sat down in a room at Monash with Erin. The conversation started with some questions about the separation with Simon in 2015 and how the custody arrangements had been managed between the two of them since then. Erin told Katrina a few things we hadn't heard before. She talked about the children having weekends with Simon and that she would have them during the week. However, the children started to talk to her about not wanting to go to Simon's for the weekend and wanting to stay home. They talked about Dad yelling at them and him sleeping a lot on the weekend, so they weren't really wanting to go. Well, I thought that was a fair swipe at Simon, the man who, we should remember, might or might not have just accused Erin of poisoning his parents. Sarah Lenthal, who was guiding Katrina through her evidence in chief, simply moved on and asked Katrina what Erin had said about Erin's relationship with Simon. She talked about feeling that he was at times controlling and emotionally abusive, and that he would say things to her that would make her doubt herself as a parent and also impacted her self-esteem. But she did say they had a good relationship until recently. Erin told Katrina that Simon had been mean, but never more than that until the row over child support payments at the end of 2022. That's when he had become nasty to her, Katrina recalled. This was rapidly becoming quite a hit job. Was it all to make sure she didn't lose her kids? Had that become one of her sudden fears? Okay, so that was Erin's opinion of Simon. What about the wider Patterson family? She said Don and Gail had been like the parents she hadn't had. Her parents had died quite some time ago, that they'd always treated her like a daughter-in-law, and that she cared and loved them very much and felt very supported by them. Ah, there we were, back to the revered shrine. But that relationship had also changed recently as well. She felt isolated from them. She said since the relationship between her and Simon had changed, that she felt he was isolating her from her family. Erin had then talked to Katrina about the lunch. She told Katrina that she had invited everyone over to discuss a medical issue, including how to broach that issue with her children. Then they went through the lunch menu, which Erin had already repeated with several other people. It must have been getting very tedious. This time she said the dried mushrooms she'd got from an Asian grocer had come from Oakley or Clayton. She wasn't sure. Then came a small surprise. Did Erin describe how she had served the lunch? She said that she had dished up all the plates and everyone had come over and chosen their own. She took one that was left over and put two aside for the children. Two? Had she really made seven Wellingtons? Or had she made eight? She had bought enough eye fillet to make eight. Five contaminated ones, the fifth one in case Simon turned up, one for her and two for the kids. That was starting to make sense, although it was never really cleared up. I never really could figure out exactly how many she'd made. More importantly, Erin had also told Katrina that she had started to feel unwell that evening. and she was experiencing loose bowel movements when she had to take Jack's friend home around 7:30 p.m., recalled Katrina. And Jack went into the supermarket to buy something and she stayed in the car because she felt it would provide a cork so she wouldn't have an accident. "Provide a what, sorry?" asked a flustered Sarah. "A cork." "A cork? So she wouldn't have an accident." "Oh, okay." Even murder trials need the odd laugh, and here it was. On a more serious note, however, this was yet another time when Erin's memory of the time her gastro symptoms began, if they really had, made it tough to figure out when she'd actually eaten the death cap mushrooms, if at all. Erin also told Katrina about the first time Simon called her on the Sunday morning after the lunch. According to the notes Naomi took at this time, Erin said, Simon had told her that the others were really sick too. That didn't help Erin's case. She had been trying to make us believe that, early on, she had never really been told just how sick Don, Gail, Ian and Heather were. But she did know they were at least really sick on Sunday morning. I was going to call that a fact. That was becoming undeniable. At 3:30 p.m., while Erin was in the middle of retelling that story of Saturday's lunch to Katrina, Erin's phone rang and she let it go to voicemail. A little later, it dinged with a text message from Sally Ann Atkinson. Several plans had been designed and approved by that morning's crisis meeting, but many of those plans couldn't be properly actioned until Sally gained further information from Erin. When Katrina wrapped up her interview, she left the room with Naomi so they could have a final chat with the two kids. Erin now had an opportunity to read Sally Ann's text. "Hi, Erin. Sally Ann from the Department of Health. I spoke with you this morning. I have left a message for you to call me, but thought it might be helpful if I let you know the sort of information I wanted to discuss. I need to know what drinks were served at lunch. I also need to know what type of shallots you purchased, and if you could please give me a basic description of the packaging of the mushrooms from the Asian grocer, that would be good." Hadn't she done that? Or had she told that to someone else? In the context of what she'd had to cope with over the last 2 days, I can imagine Erin feeling drained as she read the rest of Sally Ann's text. Approximate weight and size of the packaging. Was it partially see-through or not? And if you can think of the names of the roads you were parked on or near where you went to the different grocery stores, then I can get officers out looking around those areas. Even a landmark you might have remembered at the time would be helpful. Just things to think about for when I talk to you again. Thank you, Sally. Who'd expected this sort of frenzy? By 4:08 p.m., while Katrina and Naomi were still chatting with the kids, Erin texted Sally Ann back. She wanted to sound helpful without actually engaging. She needed time to think and breathe. "Hi, Sally. Sure, I will try to get that information all to you as soon as possible. I'm just dealing with trying to manage that. I'll get this info to you as soon as I can, but I've just been in a couple of meetings with people at the hospital when you've been trying to call." She'd barely hit send when Sally Ann's reply landed. "Thanks so much. I understand. Are your kids doing okay at the moment? I will try calling you later this afternoon around 5. Erin shot off a quick reply, trying to round off the convo. "Yeah, they're fine. Thanks. Thank you." As Erin swiped away the message app, Katrina returned with good news, mostly. They had made a determination. The kids could stay with Erin, but that could only be an interim finding until Katrina had assessed the home environment, just standard procedure. Could she schedule a visit to Gibson Street tomorrow, 1 o'clock? "Sure," said Erin. "Great. How are you getting home?" Erin had been wondering the same thing. While she had been talking to Katrina, the kids had been discharged and now they were just hanging around in the corridor. Simon had left. He told the kids he was going to see Nana and Papa, which meant he was on his way to the Austin. But Erin's car was back at Leongatha Hospital. Katrina and Naomi offered to drive Erin and the kids back to Leongatha. At Leongatha, Naomi said her goodbyes and Katrina reminded Erin she'd see her tomorrow. The kids climbed into Erin's car. It was only a 10-minute trip home. At the Austin, Simon was in a huddle with some very worried ICU specialists. Nothing was working. While they were sharing this news with Simon, the Austin's admin staff were also emailing the same update to Steve Eppingstall at Homicide. Steve and his team were just starting to take a closer look at all this. It might not end up with them, but if they were to be honest, it did already have a feel about it. Erin and the kids arrived home a little after 5 p.m. If it was innocent Erin who arrived home, she'd had a hell of an afternoon. She was still shaking from Simon's accusation, denied by Simon, that she'd poisoned his parents. She was now wondering if, in fact, she might have. It had been a total accident, of course. But what if she had added those mushies she'd foraged from the local parks in April and May? And if she had, could she talk her way out of it now? What would it look like? She'd honestly thought it was that other dried stuff which she'd bought in Oakley or wherever that had made everyone sick. But did that just sound like a cover story now? Or was it still better than admitting she must have harvested deathcap mushrooms from somewhere, however unintentionally? If it was guilty Erin who arrived home, she'd had a hell of an afternoon. This was all getting worse and worse. The questions were multiplying. More and more people were involved. They were going over everything in ever finer detail. How was she going to stay out of trouble? Could anyone prove she'd picked deathcap mushrooms? If so, how? What trails had she left? At 5:22 p.m., Sally Ann Atkinson called Erin again, as she promised she would. To Sally Ann's building frustration, Erin didn't answer again. No one knows why she didn't answer. That'd just be pure speculation. But I'm imagining Erin dropped her bag on the table and walked into the kitchen. The kids ran straight to the TV computer room. The phone rang and Erin stared at the caller ID. Fuck, no. She threw the phone down on the kitchen bench. And there, also on the bench, staring her in the face, was her Sunbeam dehydrator. The machine she had used to dry her wild-picked mushrooms once she'd sliced and diced them. And a child protection officer was coming around the very next day.